Okay, so we're moving now to happening right here at WSLR Live. And the first thing that I'm going to do is turn on the microphone of my guest, Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, geriatrician, and member of the American Board of Holistic Physicians. And so welcome, Fred Harvey.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Glad to have you on the air. And I understand that very recently you went to a pretty remarkable educational event.
I did. Normally, when doctors go to educational events, or when I've gone in the past, they've been simply didactic seminars. You sit in an audience and listen to somebody spout some information with a bunch of slides, and you take notes, and then you go away. This was actually different. A couple of university primary care doctors actually presented some very interesting specialty information. We delved down into some very complex cases, but we did it in a round table fashion. There were 14 tables of eight, and everyone had a number. So the doctors would present information, and then we'd get a case, and we would discuss it. And they would go table to table and ask the speaker that was the organizer for each table to tell what that table had come up with. And it was very engaging, very interesting, and we really delved down into some controversial issues and some very complex cases.
Well, the controversial issues that I've seen lately, I did a show about it 2 weeks ago, about the way that vitamins have been lambasted in the press in the recent past. But, you know, the other thing that's really been on the top of the list is the cholesterol story. You know, when they came out with a whole bunch of new guidelines for cholesterol, it sounded like everybody over 8 years old in America qualified to go on statin drugs. And I know that wasn't the case, but let's just talk about those new guidelines.
Well, let's talk about the old guidelines first. And this is what made me crazy, and I think made you crazy, is that it was pretty much a cookbook, knee-jerk, treat to the numbers rather than treating to the individual kind of non-medicine. Simply dial in an LDL cholesterol number, that's the not as beneficial cholesterol, and dial it down with a statin drug. And that was just simply ludicrous. We were treating numbers, not people.
Well, I know the same thing happens when, you know, when you look at a person, a whole person, you know, holistic medicine, look at all of the factors that are going on, then the formula answers are not always the best answers.
That's right. And so when you look at cholesterol, which is such an important molecule in our bodies, cholesterol is the foundational building block for all of our steroid hormones. That means cortisol, the stress hormone, and all of the sex hormones, progesterone, testosterone, estradiol, the major female hormone, these are all derived from cholesterol.
So if well, not only that, cholesterol is in the cell wall of every cell in our body, and it is the most prevalent molecule that's in the brain.
Yes, it makes up like 10% of all of our cell membranes. So it's a very important structural chemical, too. So when we lose our reserves of cholesterol, we start to unravel the very cells that we're made up of. And so that leads to brain dysfunction, heart dysfunction, liver dysfunction, muscle dysfunction. There's a lot of different things that can happen when you interrupt this very important natural molecule's production.
Thinking dysfunction, muscle coordination.
And liver failure.
Yeah.
So, you know, using these medications with some more thought placed into the guidelines, into the actual treatment of an individual, makes a lot of sense. So the new guidelines came out in October, and they immediately created a controversy in many cardiologists. Harvard cardiologists wrote several editorials about how everybody in the country is going to be on statins because of these new guidelines.
Well, you know, when I look at treating cholesterol, what I see that happens with an awful lot of doctors is exactly what you said. They just treat to the number. If your cholesterol is 224, if it's 205, if it's anything under 200, you need to be on a statin drug. So how do these new guidelines create a rational look at cholesterol and how to treat it?
Well, instead of just treating to the number, they actually expand the way we think about the whole issue. I guess really the reason that we're in this situation is that overall there is a lot of evidence that statins are highly effective. There are certain groups of people that really benefit. And this is one of the things they've done with the guidelines. They've broken it down into groups of people that are at highest risk. So when you look at it, there are certain people that they really recommend everybody in this group should be on it. Diabetics with cardiac risk factors all should be on a statin drug, of course.
Well, let's look at what those cardiac risk factors are. I know one of the very first ones is being a smoker.
Right.
Being male.
Yes.
Having a family history.
That's right.
Having high blood pressure.
Another one.
Having had a prior event.
Absolutely.
Having these cholesterol numbers that are wacky doodle.
And the family history, actually, I want to go into that, is a little bit more strict than just having somebody who had a heart attack, you know, at 85 in your family. It's having a first-degree relative, that's mother, father, brother, sister, who died or actually had a major cardiac event, a heart attack, a male before age 55, a female before age 50. So these are very early heart attacks. And so that is a big risk. But when you look at the groups that they're talking about, anyone with diabetes who's got the risk factor of being over age 40.
So we're talking about diabetes type 1 or diabetes type 2 or all diabetes?
All diabetes. Any diabetic who's age 40 and over, they're suggesting should be on a statin to reduce the risk of an event because diabetes is so devastating to the vascular system. They suggest anybody with an LDL over 190, which is a pretty high LDL. Those people they're suggesting need statin therapy. And like you said, anybody that has a cardiovascular disease, angina, you know, chest pain from heart disease, a prior heart attack, a prior stroke, peripheral vascular disease, any of these things are definite vascular risks. So they're suggesting all those people need to be on a statin. And that's not even looking at the numbers. They're not even looking at your cholesterol. They are saying that the risk is reduced for all of these people by going on a statin.
And then what other things did they recommend besides meds?
Well, they did expand on the previous just knee-jerk to a statin idea, especially in the group four. So those first three groups that we talked about all need a statin. But then there's the group.
So what's a group four?
Group four doesn't have cardiovascular risk. There's nobody in the family. They've never had an event. They're not a smoker. They're not high. They don't have high blood pressure. This group, they may have one of those risks. Maybe they smoke. Maybe they have high blood pressure, but it's only one risk factor that is showing up. And that could be age, too, age over 50. When you have this group, you actually then move on to doing the calculator. And the calculator is where the controversy came in, because the calculator estimates risk based on a couple of these risk factors. And the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute actually made it available online. And the American College of Cardiology has a calculator you can download and plug all the data in yourself. But it's so much easier to go to the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute and plug in your data.
And so we asked you to get a pencil and paper out when you're listening to the show. And what you're going to write down is CVD. That stands for cardiovascular disease. CVD. CVDrisk.nhlbi.nih.gov/calculator ASP. We're going to repeat this again later in the show, but I'm going to do it now all in one hunk, and that is CVDrisk.nhlbi.nih.gov/calculator ASP. When you go up on that risk calculator, they're going to ask you seven questions. And those seven questions are yes or no, and then you're going to plug in numbers. You're going to put in your blood pressure. You're going to put in your HDL reading. When you do that, you're going to get an established risk factor of what your probability is of having a cardiovascular incident over the next 10 years. And so last night when I went up on that particular site and I put in all my numbers, my risk factor was 3%. The risk of me having a heart attack over the next 10 years is 3% based on my numbers. So that puts me in
a non-risk category.
Group four.
You're already in group four because you're not a smoker. You don't have diabetes.
I'm not hypertensive.
You don't have an LDL over 190. So those are the first.
And I have no family members, first degree relatives that have had a cardiovascular incident.
Right. So since that puts you already in group four, then you use the calculator. In the group four people, it's recommended that anybody who has a percent risk of 7.5% or greater, those people need statin therapy. And that's where the controversy comes in, because if you take it down to 7.5%, you're actually getting a large portion of the United States and of the world to need statins. In
so then you just put it in the public water supply.
Exactly. And that's what these Harvard doctors were concerned about.
Well, and it's what I would be concerned about, simply because of the fact that I know that statins create good news. When there are individuals who've had a heart attack, when there are individuals who've had cardiovascular surgery, they've had a stent put in, they've had a valve replaced, they've had a bypass surgery, you know, something has been done. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt by looking at those stats that statins make a huge big difference in survival when people are on those drugs for a year or longer after they've had that incident.
It's so true. If I happened to be required to have a stent, I would be on Crestor or Lipitor or one of these brand name things for the time duration afterwards that stabilizes that artery, because after those procedures, risk is huge. To have a stent put in, the risk of having a heart attack without any kind of additional therapies like the blood thinner Plavix or the statin drugs, you're looking at a 100-fold increased risk of having a heart attack in the next 3 months after the procedure.
And we mentioned brand names, and it's important to understand that these brand names were the ones that were revealed by the study to be the most effective.
Yes.
And that are those are Crestor, Lipitor, and Zocor. Now, it's important to understand that what happens with Crestor is Crestor doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. And the reason that's important is because the glial cells in your brain actually manufacture cholesterol all by themselves. And so when we have statin drugs that cross over the blood-brain barrier, those are the ones that potentially can affect memory, potentially can affect cognition. They can affect the way that our brain works. And so that's one of the reasons, Dr. Harvey, that I've seen in my practice, I think in my small practice, a disproportionate number of individuals that 6 weeks after they've gone on a statin drug, they're depressed.
Yes.
And then they turn around and go on an antidepressant drug. And the doctor says, well, you're just depressed because you're older. You're just depressed because you've got this, you know, potential for heart disease. And yet, when these people came off statin drugs, their depression went away. So I think it's important to understand that there is a certain population that absolutely their thinking process is affected by statin drugs.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, and you actually you have the book in your hand right now by Dr. Duane Graveline. He actually had transient global amnesia. In other words, he totally lost his memory because he took Lipitor. It is highly effective at crossing the blood-brain barrier, and it was highly effective at erasing his memory while he was on it.
So, well, fortunately, his transient global amnesia only lasted for 24 hours, but in that 24 hours, he forgot that he was an astronaut. He forgot that he was a doctor. He forgot his wife that he'd been married to for 40 years. That's a really lot to forget.
That's some major forgetting.
So. Well, but the most important thing about Dr. Duane Graveline's story is the fact that when he wrote a letter into one of the popular columns in the paper saying I had had this episode of transient global amnesia, because after he had it, everybody that he talked to among his own colleagues as a physician and among the people at NASA, because he was an astronaut, so he was being evaluated by the Houston Space Center, every one of them said, oh, statins don't do that, statins don't do that, statins don't do that. And yet when he put the letter in the People's Pharmacy column, 4,000 responses came back of individuals who'd had incidences of transient global amnesia on statin drugs.
And that's so amazing. And that's one of the really interesting things about the research, because that does occur. But there's a review study that looked at one of the reasons they're recommending that all these people be on statins is that there's a review of about 56,000 patients in numerous studies that showed that this is a primary prevention study. So what this looked at was people that had one or zero risk factor. So basically not in the groups that would suggest that you need to be on a statin to start with. Overall, when they studied them and plugged them into the equation, their overall risk factor for having a heart attack in 10 years was only 15%. So they put these 56,000 people on a variety of different statin drugs. And what they found out is that all-cause mortality was reduced. In other words, deaths from falling out of a tree, deaths from lightning strike, deaths from drowning.
Slipping in the shower and breaking your neck.
All these things went down. My suspicion is that they went down because during these potentially hazardous activities, people probably had small vascular events and died from the other cause because nobody caught the vascular event because right. It was minor. So Really what happens is, though, huge benefits in vascular disease, 25% reduction in all cardiovascular events over the time of the studies, 22% reduction in stroke, 38% reduction in going on to get bypass surgery, 38% reduction in that. So
that's astounding.
They work. And this is in people, though, that aren't sick, don't have cardiovascular risk of any great amount, and yet they were put on statins to study and see what the overall effect was.
And yet, what I see in my practice, I mean, just last week, I had a new client, 49 years old. She was on 7 medications. And, you know, she has a risk profile, as I see it, because she's hypertensive. She has low HDL. There's a family history. She's a smoker. You know, all of those things are playing. She's a time bomb.
Exactly. She is someone who probably could benefit from the statin therapy. But if you just take out a variable like the cigarettes, you'll reduce that risk by several percent at least.
Well, you know, that's a whole other show that we can do about stopping smoking. Now that we've gotten the American population below 20%, 18% now of American adults are still smoking. And so clearly negative motivation doesn't work.
Right.
And so, you know, we've got to find another approach, and it's got to be something other than another drug.
Agreed.
No question about it. But, you know, what I'm hearing is that the treatment of cholesterol now is actually going to require doctors to think.
Oh, my.
What a concept.
Cookbooks anymore.
What a concept. It's not going to be cookbook medicine anymore. And actually, it's going to allow the consumer to be able to do their own homework by going up on the calculator and figuring out what their risk factors are. And then maybe I'm going to get less individuals that walk into my clinic and say, I just want off the meds. And I go, well, that may not be possible. You know, I have people that come into my office that think they can just trade a medication for an herb
right.
or a medication for a vitamin without understanding that I'm not anti-drug. I'm just anti-inappropriate use of drug. And I'm also in favor of looking at the potential effects of the drugs, because as you've stated eloquently on this show before, they're not side effects. You know, we call them side effects, and we seem to have accepted the fact that when you take a drug, there's going to be this list they're going to read you on television that says, oh, by the way, if you go blind, you probably ought to stop using this. But the nature of that is we've accepted the fact that side effects are part and parcel of a drug, when in fact, they're not side effects at all.
They are concurrent effects. No one drug has one effect. They're chemicals that pervade every cell in your body, and so they affect all kinds of systems, and those systems in turn affect other systems. So they affect actually the entire metabolism of your body, even though it seems like it's one item that they're being labeled to treat.
And so even the people that come out on the calculator to say that they belong on a statin drug and they're willing to go on the statin drug, one of the first things that we want to remind everybody is that statin drugs deplete coenzyme Q10. And coenzyme Q10 is an essential nutrient. And the nature of this essential nutrient, which means we have to get it from our food, we have to get it from our plate, we have to get it from a supplement, this essential nutrient is part of what's known as the electron transport chain inside the mitochondria of the cell. Now, what the heck does that mean? That means your ability to make energy inside your cell. And when you think about the heart muscle uses more energy than any other equal weight area in the body. You know, if you open and close your fist 60 times in a minute and you did that over 24 hours, your arm would fall off. You couldn't possibly create enough energy. Most clients, when I ask them to open and close their fist and open and close their fist and open and close their fist, after 20 seconds, they're begging me to stop. And yet your heart's going to do that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, hopefully for 80 plus years. And so there's a tremendous amount of energy, a tremendous amount of electricity electron transport chain in the mitochondria that are taking place inside the heart. And because statin drugs affect the pathway that manufactures coenzyme Q10, there are some instances where we look at the charts that say that the incident of heart failure, not heart attack, but heart failure, where the muscle of the heart gets like elastic in old underwear. It just doesn't have any snap anymore. It doesn't completely empty out the oxygenated blood. The heart gets weaker and weaker. And that the rise in congestive heart failure is in direct proportion to the rise in the use of statin drugs. So there's no way that we can possibly do this show without telling everybody out there that's on a statin drug, any statin drug, that you must, underlined, emphasized in gold letters, must be taking coenzyme Q10 with your supplements every single day.
It's so true. However, recent reading on my part from the other school suggests that there's not enough data to recommend the use of CoQ10 in statins per Western medicine. However, the studies that began to show a result in cardiac illness were started in the 90s at the University of Texas, showing that CoQ10 actually took class 4 heart failure up to class 2, class 3 up to class 1. Class 1 basically is you have a normal life, you just have a little bit of sluggish heart pump. So it really restores functionality in people with heart failure. So though the study hasn't been done, I think it's pretty fair to extrapolate that if you have something that would limit your heart pump, taking some CoQ would probably bring you back up.
And we remind you also that coenzyme Q10 must be taken in a gel form to really have good efficacy. When you take coenzyme Q10 in the powder form, when it's a powder inside of a capsule, it barely has 30% uptake. And so what we're looking for is the gel form of coenzyme Q10.
Yeah, it's a much more effective and more deliverable method, especially if you take it with a fatty meal. So the other thing that came out of that prevention study, and this is something that comes up often, and many people in my practice want off their medication because of these complaints: muscle aches, increase in joint aches or arthritis, abnormal liver function tests, kidney failure, cancer, and then the unraveling of the muscles called rhabdomyolysis. These things in the primary prevention study really didn't show up at any greater rate than in the placebo or the control groups.
But remember, the people that were studied were people that were healthy.
That's the key right here. This is where the guidelines really have to come into play, because I see it, and I know that Eve sees it. There are more complications, especially in the neurologic field, when you're dealing with diabetics and you put diabetics on these kind of medications that already risk the integrity of the nervous system. Their nervous system is already jeopardized by the diabetes. These are the kind of people we start to see more effect in, more concurrent adverse effect. The people that are on several medications for high blood pressure or other illnesses that then may interact with the statin drug and deplete CoQ10 or other resources further. So it's the people in the groups 1, 2, and 3 that have the higher risk for having complications. The ones that need the statins the most are at the most risk. So they're the ones that we need to pay the most attention to and use the most caution when applying these medications, but actually using them smartly and judiciously, but supporting with things like coenzyme Q10.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that we talk about a fair amount here on No Nonsense Nutrition is the fact that if there is one objective that you have in your whole life as far as your health is concerned, it's to make sure you don't become a diabetic.
Yes.
Because diabetes speeds the rate of heart disease by 400%. Diabetes doubles your risk of dementia, and on and on and on. And so the individuals that are diabetic that are listening to the show, the thing that we continue to encourage you to do is get your hemoglobin A1C tested on a regular basis and keep that hemoglobin A1C number as low as possible. Very often physicians are just happy with any number in the sixes, 6.4, 6.8. As far as they're concerned, if it's under 7, it's a happy number. With Dr. Harvey and I, we're looking for numbers well down down into the fives. So we very much change our risk of brain shrinkage as we age. Remember, brain and atrophy are not two words that you really want in the same sentence. And so, you know, shrinking your brain, no, it doesn't just happen in Washington, D.C. It can happen to any one of us. And so if you are, in fact, already diabetic, the individuals who test their blood sugar on a very regular basis, people who test their blood sugar five times a day, even though that seems like it's a pain in the bottom, the nature of the people who test their blood sugar regularly that have way better control over their blood sugar have a way different risk factor of heart disease and dementia across the board. So, you know, those of you that have bypassed that particular lesson in health, remember to get your hemoglobin A1C tested every time you get your blood work done. It's looking at your blood glucose management over several months rather than simply looking at what your glucose number is the minute they pull the needle out of your arm.
Yes, that one spot glucose varies so rapidly that it's not worth it to do just that. However, the fasting blood sugar in the morning with the finger stick is a really good baseline. If you awaken with a blood sugar over 95, you've got to wonder what's going on with your glucose metabolism. Anything over 100 is really considered in the diabetic spectrum at this point. We're looking for numbers in the mid-80s to low-90s at the most to show that you have really good glycemic control, which means that your dinner from the night before has been metabolized, you slept well, and you didn't have any bumps during the night that would have required more sugar, more insulin to deal with the case. So you wake up in the morning with a normal range blood sugar.
I'm waiting for the day that we have a campaign against all soda pop in this nation, and I'm afraid that I may have to wait until my next life in order for that to happen, because since soda pop is the single biggest source of sugar in the American diet in the form of high fructose corn syrup, and it, you know, it doesn't really matter what the source of sugar is. It doesn't matter whether it's a glass of wine or it's agave syrup or it's maple syrup or it's brown sugar or it's white sugar or it's pink sugar or anything else. The idea is sugar and maple syrup and honey and agave and soda pop, you know, and liquor, you know, all of them end up the same place. So do white potatoes and white bread and white rice. And, you know, those things all can elevate blood sugar enough that we develop diabetes. And as a result of that, greatly increase our cardiovascular risk.
I think the easiest way, rather than campaigning against it, we tax alcohol, we tax tobacco. I think we should simply tax high fructose corn syrup at about 50 or 100% markup from the manufacturer.
So that big vat of soda that you can buy down the street at the convenience store costs $8 instead of one.
Yeah, you know, a premium beer costs good $8
idea.
Now. An $8 good gulp? That sounds like a brilliant idea.
Good idea. So let's look at these three drugs that clearly have given us benefit and say, what other things can we do to modify the potential correlative factors that can happen for individuals, like we're doing with coenzyme Q10 and congestive heart failure and energy?
Well, I really like the fact that the new guidelines actually say that we need to address as step two in the guidelines. Look at cholesterol first, but then start to look at lifestyle. And lifestyle medicine is actually becoming a specialty, but it's really simple stuff. Exercise and change your diet. However, in
what
this,
a concept.
It's true. It's so simple.
How radical that doctors would actually think about exercising and changing your food choices.
And that's really what they looked at, food choices. They really didn't include anything else. They admitted in their work when they created these guidelines, they didn't have the time or the resources to look at anything except for diet. So they didn't look at whether you took in some extra magnesium or calcium or how much alcohol you drank. They didn't look at cardiorespiratory fitness. They didn't look at single intervention or single behavioral intervention like starting to exercise versus multiple component changes. Most people, when they start to do these things, when even I coach people to change, we recommend some diet, some exercise, some supplementation, even with me, medication changes. So it's a multi-component intervention. They haven't looked at that. And they haven't looked at whether the addition of lifestyle changes to pharmaceuticals or to smoking regimens, if people still smoke and we add exercise or diet, well, they haven't looked at any of these things. They simply looked at diet and cardiovascular risk. And the biggest diet they looked at was the DASH diet.
The dietary approach to stop hypertension, D-A-S-H. A diet that is, first off, low in sodium, 1,500 milligrams or less. You know, a teaspoon of salt has 2,100 milligrams of sodium in it. And I told this story on the air one other time that we had a client who grew up in the South who called us up one day on the phone and said, I be swole. I be all swole. And so I said, well, what'd you have for dinner? And she'd gone out to one of the local Chinese eateries and she had had mushu pork. And so she said, but I only ate half of it. And I know she is a, you know, really good eater. You know, she's a hearty eater. And so I said, well, why did you only eat half of it? And she said, because I started the meal with hot and sour soup. So I went up on that company's website and I looked up the mushu pork. And the mushu pork had 7,900 milligrams of sodium. So she ate half of that. So she had about 4,000 milligrams of sodium,
two
or just slightly less than 2 teaspoons. Oof. But the reason she only ate half of it is because she had hot and sour soup. And the hot and sour soup, which she had every bite,
right?
Had 5,000 milligrams of sodium. So she had 9,000 milligrams of sodium in a single meal. That's over 4 teaspoons of salt. No wonder she be swole.
That's really almost a week's recommendation for a hypertensive patient.
Right. So when the DASH diet says 1,500 milligrams of salt, first off, you don't go to that Chinese restaurant. But the second thing is we have to realize that, you know, a single can of soup can have 760 milligrams of sodium.
Right.
In a serving, and a single can of soup, if you look on the label, says it's 2 servings. For who? Barbie? So the situation is that when you're eating processed food and when you're eating out in a restaurant, you may be getting sodium in foods without realizing it, because something doesn't have to taste salty in other to be salty. You know, if I give you a half a cup of vanilla pudding and I give you an ounce of Planters cocktail nuts, it's easy to think that the Planters cocktail nuts are high in salt, but in fact, the vanilla pudding has more. If I send you to a well-known fast food restaurant to get a milkshake and an order of fries, the milkshake actually has more sodium than the order of fries. So it doesn't have to taste salty to be salty.
That's exactly it. And so when you look at this DASH diet, it really is a very balanced diet. It's high in vegetable fiber.
Yeah, baby.
They're saying around 10 servings of vegetables a day. Or,
and a serving is a half a cup cooked and 1 cup raw.
Exactly. And when you look at the breakdown, they're saying 8 servings of veg and 2 servings of fruit. Which makes sense because the fruit has higher amounts of sugar, and we want to avoid that sugar load because we want to avoid diabetes. The next tier on the DASH pyramid would be grains. They're suggesting 6 servings of whole grain a day. There is some controversy about this, and I think that would take another whole show to actually tease that completely out, but...
What I see is Americans don't eat whole grains.
That's right.
What I see is Americans eat flour. They eat bread. They eat pizza dough. They eat cookies. They eat pasta. They eat flour. And so, you know, I collect cookbooks and you've seen them.
Yes, I got
100 of them. And if I go back to the cookbooks from 100 years ago, what I find is that people actually were eating whole grain. They were not eating, tear open the packet, pour the oatmeal in some water and stick it in a microwave for a minute, cream of paste.
Right.
They were actually eating cooked whole oats. So the effect of these cooked whole grains, the difference between brown rice and white rice alone is very significant. And by the time somebody's eaten puffed rice in the cereals, I mean, that is nothing but a sugar bomb. You know, when you overcook your rice, when you puff your rice, you increase the glycemic load, not just the glycemic index, but the glycemic load, how much of that sugar stays in your system for how long.
And how much is available? Because once you break down all those cell walls and open up all the sugar, all the starches to be available to digest, which is not what happens in whole grains. If you think about it, you take a serving of steel-cut oats. I cook mine overnight. I put them in boiling water when I go to bed and heat them up in the morning because by then they're cooked. It takes a lot of time to get that water into that grain. It's a completely different substance than that powdery wallpaper paste that comes out of the packet.
So I'm going to stand in disagreement with the DASH diet's recommendation of 8 servings of grain, because what we've learned from David Perlmutter in the book Grain Brain and what we've learned about the relationship of gluten to individuals, especially individuals with diabetes, and their risk of dementia is such that reducing grain across the board, I think, is a good idea.
I thoroughly agree, and especially the gluten grain, gluten-containing grains, wheat, barley, spelt, kamut, and
rye.
Those 5 really need to be avoided if you want to avoid dementia and many other medical issues. So, if you do use grain, use smart grains like quinoa and buckwheat.
Amaranth.
And amaranth. These are different kinds of grains, and if you use them whole, they're very tasty. You don't even need to grind them. You can make cereal out of them. You can make salads with them. But those kind of grains are less readily available, so it makes grain something that you have to work for rather than a convenience food where you can grab a bag of bagel chips and munch away. That changes the nature of how we're getting the food as well.
And so what we're looking at is we're looking at dairy products and meat as proteins in there, and the DASH diet recommends low fat in terms of that particular instance. In other words, they're much more in favor of you having the turkey breast that I'm going to have as my sandwich for lunch today on whole grain bread, I might add. Getting on an airplane, you want to remember the first rule. Never get on an airplane hungry. Never get on an airplane without food.
That's so true.
But the nature of recommending the turkey breast over the pork ribs, simply because of the quality of fat that's in there, is also part of the DASH diet. And so, you know, what's the part that I cheer for the most? It's more vegetables, more vegetables, more vegetables. Did I mention more vegetables? You know, this is my 26th year in practice in Sarasota, and I have yet to meet anybody who's come into my practice that eats more vegetables than I do.
It's really tough. I try to keep up with you. I love my vegetables, too. And I disagree a bit with the DASH diet as well, because I agree with Dr. Perlmutter about the overall amount of grains. And one of the ways that he recommends that we change our caloric intake to meet the requirements is to cut back on the grains but add more fat. And so more nuts and seeds, not with meat, though. Still, we need to limit the amount of meat. The paleo diet, where you eat meat all day long, that is just injurious to your kidneys. It's not the way we need to actually function. Vegetables are what really fuels our bodies. So if we add a little bit of coconut oil, a little bit of ghee, other kinds of oils to make the meal more satisfying, more flavorful, and have more calories that last us longer is better than adding more grain.
Well, and you know, when we're talking about things like ghee, which is clarified butter, butter that we've removed all the milk solids out of, and coconut oil and good oils, avocado oil, walnut oil, you know, these oils, and again, I'm down on canola oil, not recommending canola oil in any way, shape, or form. I don't care what they say on the Rachel Ray Show. The nature of these fats, they slow the emptying time of the stomach. And when we slow the emptying time of the stomach, we have a greater amount of satiety. And so that feeling of fullness stays with us when we have fats in the meal. In 1972, when we started buying into this low fat is the way to go, we started eating more sugar. And so, you know, when we look at the rate of diabetes having escalated markedly since the low fat diet started, we realize that we have to bring these fats back in. Our cell membranes are made out of a combination of cholesterol and fat. And so when we have good quality fats, and, you know, I just had a class on Saturday, and I said to the group in the class, if you only buy one organic product, you're not on board in terms of organic products. And you say, okay, Eve, I'm going to buy one thing organically. What's it going to be? And the answer is butter. The federal government actually uses butter as a way to evaluate how much pesticides our children are being exposed to. Because pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, toxins accumulate in the fat of animals. And so that shows up in the butter of the milk. And so when we take organic butter and turn it into ghee, you know, let it very easily simmer on the stove until we evaporate all the water out and then let the butter reharden, and that white scum that's on the top when the melted butter rehardens are the milk solids. We can wipe them off with a paper towel. And so using things like ghee and coconut oil and high quality meats, the pasture raised meats, the organically raised meats, you know, my recommendation to people is eat less meat, but eat better quality meat.
Yes. Pay a bit more, eat a bit less. You'll be much better off. I think that many of the pork sensitivity reactions that I see in my clinic are due to the antibiotic load in the pork fat. They use so many antibiotics in non-organic pork. If you make that switch, you'll be taking your penicillin and other antibacterial load way down and reducing that burden of toxicity on your body.
Yeah, and when I tell people that 74% of all the feed that the FDA has approved for chickens in the United States contains arsenic, and people go, oh, that can't be possible. But these small amounts of arsenic act as an antiparasitic in the chickens, and so they allow the chickens to put on weight more easily because they don't get parasites. Well, some people have gone off of four-legged animals. They don't eat red meat, as they call it. And I've always thought that that was such a silly term because salmon is red and pork is white. And excuse me. and so I call them four-legged animals and two-legged animals like the First Nation people do. So when they stop eating the red meat or the four-legged animals like beef and lamb and pork, and they go to turn into chicken heads, you know, they're eating chicken. I get some food diaries in my practice where 14 lunches and dinners, they've eaten chicken 10 times. It's amazing that they're not scratching my carpet and clucking when they come in the office. And so for somebody that's eating chicken 10 times a week, the amount of arsenic that's in the chicken feed matters.
It really doesn't matter
if you're eating it, you know, four or less times a week. Because when we look at 14 lunches and dinners, what I'm hoping for is at least four of those meals are vegetarian. Four of those meals come from seafood. Four of those meals come from birds, and maybe two of those meals come from four-legged animals.
Yeah, the DASH diet actually really does limit the amount of animal product intake. And Dean Ornish's diet, which is very similar for reversing heart disease, has one serving of fish per week and two servings of chicken per month. But the DASH diet, it allows you about four servings of animal per week.
The main thing is we got tons of vegetables.
Yeah, we do.
And as soon as we look at tons of vegetables, we see people getting healthier right away.
So one of the third guideline that they suggest is to manage obesity because it's such a major problem. Well, that just reflects back, I think, on the lifestyle issues. But we really do need to go beyond the diet. And everybody needs exercise to lose the weight, to maintain your vascular system. 30 minutes of aerobics a day is really critical. How else can we actually make the metabolism work well? We reset the insulin resistance thermostat, so to speak, so we burn our sugars better, reducing the risk of diabetes. We pump blood, nutrients, oxygen into small arterioles, the tiny little microvessels that basically stay closed unless you increase your blood pressure with exercise. Increasing your blood pressure with simply high blood pressure actually clamps down those tiny blood vessels. But if you increase it with exercise, you pop those open and you get better brain circulation, better toe circulation, better heart circulation everywhere if you actually get the exercise.
Well, and, you know, I think we made a mistake when we called it exercise. I think we should have called it activity.
Yes.
Because people resist it so much. And, you know, when I tell people to start out with, doing 30 minutes a day of exercise, what's actually true is that we just need to move. And so if walking out the door for 10 minutes you know, in one direction and turning around and walking back to the house again. You know, that 20 minutes is something that anybody can do.
Absolutely.
When we're looking for that 150 minutes a week, you know, we can get there with 22 minutes every day. We can get there with, you know, 30 minutes 5 days a week.
Yes.
But the idea is just to be doing something that keeps you in continuous movement. And so, you know, I admire that my husband can leave his desk at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and take his little gym bag and go over and, you know, hang out with the muscle heads and pump iron at the gym. You know, you couldn't get me in a gym at 5 o'clock in the afternoon if you had a weapon. So the nature of it is you've got to find an exercise that fits with that particular individual
so
that they'll stay with it. And so for one person, walking in their neighborhood is maybe not safe. Maybe it's a situation where they end up with a chatty neighbor that captures them, and that's the reason that it's not safe. Maybe it's a situation where, you know, it's raining today and it's easy for them to go, ah, I'm not going to get out there.
Right.
And so we need to have a couple of different exercises so that on the days that it's raining, you can go walk the mall. You can go to the gym. On the days that you want to walk your neighborhood, that's appropriate. So for those individuals that want to ride a bike, they want to play tennis, they want to do some other activity. You know, for me, it's working in the yard with 6 oak trees in my backyard. Bending over and picking up all the moss that falls out of them is an exercise class all by itself.
Definitely.
Well, you know, go further with these 3 points. You know, we're going to treat cholesterol, we're going to do lifestyle management, and we're going to manage obesity. And, you know, we would be unfair to our listeners if we didn't say that the single most effective thing that we can possibly do to manage obesity is to eat protein and vegetables and vegetables and protein. When we reduce the amount of grain down to zero, when we reduce the amount of fruit down to darn near zero, berries only, that is still singly the most effective way I've seen to get weight off of people.
I've seen it as well. It really is the best method. And I think one of the real keys there is that it removes the convenience foods. You can't go snack, because if you don't have those flour-based crunchies around, you don't have the availability of those sudden calories that the body just isn't going to do well with. The nature of the guidelines, though, really, really, what I took away from the lecture that I went to and then reading all of the controversial rebuttals of the guidelines and then the analysis and rebuttals of those rebuttals, basically, guidelines require active participation of the physician in developing a thoughtful plan of action. This is the change. They're saying these are guidelines. So if somebody comes into my office with a 7.5 risk and they're in group 4 and they don't want to take a statin, they need an action plan. We need to set up the other things that will get them away from that 7.5% risk. Is it stopping smoking? Is it getting off the blood pressure medication by losing weight and changing the blood pressure? Is it turning back the diabetes clock? Is it getting out of that high sugar? So it's going to force the doctor, if they have the time, and this is the problem with actually using the mind during an office visit, when you have 7 minutes, you have to check the brain at the door and just use these algorithmic guidelines. Oh, you have a cholesterol problem? Here's your script. See you later. But if we can actually somehow expand the visit so the doctor has time to talk and think, they need to evaluate the whole patient and look at all the other risk factors that are coming on board. If somebody has a 7.5% risk, we can look at high-sensitive C-reactive protein, homocysteine, oxidized LDL, other risk factors that are biochemical, the biomarkers.
And that are rarely tested. You know, I get clients in my practice all the time. They've got cholesterol nailed to the ceiling. The doctor has, you know, put them on a statin drug, and yet they haven't checked these cofactors like hsCRP or homocysteine or oxidized LDL.
Or LPPLA2.
There's a, you know, physician here in town, absolutely insisting that a client be on statin drugs, and I ran an oxidized LDL test on her, and she has no oxidized LDL.
Her risk is almost none.
Just none. But she is a Scandinavian woman, and her cholesterol is about 256,
mm-hmm.
and her doctor is telling her that she's going to be dismissed as a hostile patient. if she doesn't go on a statin drug.
And what I don't understand is how a doctor can actually dismiss someone as hostile. If they talk with a person and the person doesn't want to do the recommendation, that's the patient's choice. So I really don't get that whole idea that I'm in control of your life. If you don't do what I tell you, get out of my practice ideology. It just doesn't fit with healthcare.
Well, people that are listening are happy to know that there is a physician out there who actually has both a brain and a heart, but does not give those kinds of dogmatic directions to people, because I'm dealing with people in my practice on a regular basis that their doctor has said my way or the highway.
Oh, yeah, me too. I hear it every day.
On a repeated basis. I mean, I've just had another client dismissed by a doctor because she just questioned what it was that he wanted to do.
Oh, yeah, I did too. Yeah, she asked too many questions.
Yeah. It's tough.
I thought that's what I got paid for, my intellectual property. Really, that's why somebody sits in my office.
Well,
and
that's one of the reasons that we have you a guest on No Nonsense Nutrition. Any third Monday, you're going to hear Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, geriatrician, member of the American Board of Holistic Medicine, and a man that I'm happy to call both a colleague and a friend. Thank you, Dr. Harvey.
Thank you, Eve.
And so I told you I'd give you this address one more time, and so you're going to write it down, cvdrisk.nihlbi.nih.gov/calculator ASP. Go up on there and do your seven factors, age, sex, HDL, smoking, systolic level, etc., and find out what your risk factors are, because if your risk factors are over 7.5% over the next 10 years, then it may be time for you to have a conversation with your physician, a rational look at whether you're appropriate to use statins to treat cholesterol, whether lifestyle management and the management of obesity is going to lower your risk factor and therefore the guidelines, and that if you are on drugs other than Zocor, Lipitor, and Crestor, that you may want to ask your doctor to reconsider, as those are the drugs that have clearly demonstrated the biggest difference.